solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
When you are experiencing chatter, you feel like you don't have order and control because your mind's taking over. It's taking you to places where you don't necessarily want to be and you don't know where you're going to go next. So you don't have control of what's happening in your mind. That's the feeling. What we've learned is that people can compensate for feeling out of control of their mind by exerting control on their surroundings. So when I create order around me, when I organize my space, that gives me a sense of control, which helps me feel better about my circumstances more generally. We call this process compensatory control. It's also one of the reasons why people often engage in rituals. Many athletes, for example, when they're in situations where they can't predict what's going to happen, they're competing. They will often spontaneously engage in rituals for a very similar reason. They provide them with a sense of control.
Welcome to the 96th Conversation at the Play to Potential podcast, a series of reflective conversations from leading people from various domains on three broad themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. Just like businesses think about where to play and how to win in the context of their business strategy, we all think about the two questions, where to go and how to grow, at various points in our journeys. These questions become that much harder and that much more significant in a world of abundance, multiplicity of options, and limited feedback. Through this podcast, I hope to share some insights that might help you navigate these questions in a more thoughtful way. While podcasting accounts for 10 to 20% of my time and effort, my primary vocation is that of an executive coach and a discreet sounding board with CEOs and entrepreneurs. I engage with leaders and organizations with a growth mindset and help them play to their unique potential. You can learn more about the podcast and my work at playtopotential.com. My guest this time is Ethan Cross. Ethan is one of the world's leading experts on controlling the conscious mind. He's an award-winning professor in the University of Michigan's psychology department. His research has been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the New Yorker, the New England Journal of Medicine and Science. He's recently published the book Chatter. The book goes deep into talking about the voice in our heads and how we can harness it. Through the book, he shows that instead of trying to silence your monkey mind, you can learn to educate it, motivate it, and even reason with it. Without further ado, let's jump into the conversation with Ethan Cross. Ethan, thank you so much for making the time on the Play to Potential podcast. Really excited to talk to you.
Really excited to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
In this podcast, we talk about people's journeys, Ethan. Before we dive into your book, Chatter, I'd love to talk a little bit about how you got here. So can you talk a little bit about your journey to doing what you do now?
Sure. Happy to. The journey began in Brooklyn, New York. Mm-hmm. And it started probably around the age of somewhere between 3 and 5 when I first started talking to my dad about life, because he liked to talk to me about such things.
Wow.
And my dad was a really interesting character. On the one hand, he fit the stereotype of a classic, I would say, middle-class New Yorker, growing up in the 1970s when he did. And he loved watching the New York Yankees, and he was aggressive when he drove his car, and uttered all sorts of expletives when he did, even though uh-huh. I was in the back seat. So on the surface, he had this very gruff exterior, but in his spare time, he would love to read about in Eastern philosophy. And so, like, one of his favorite texts was the Bhagavad Gita.
Wow.
And he was deeply, deeply immersed. And I should say, he was not an academic. He didn't graduate from college. He was a salesman, but he was enamored with the science of mind. And he used to talk to me beginning from around the time I was three about what he was reading about and learning. And one of the first lessons he shared was, he would say to me, hey, whenever something bad happens, go inside, find the kernel of truth, and, you know, just try to get to the bottom of it. So go inside was this little phrase that he would utter to me throughout my childhood and adolescence. And, you know, I found this terribly embarrassing when I was growing up. My dad would talk to me about these things, like often in front of my friends when they would come over. But like so many things in a young child's life, the things we hear our parents talk about and talk to us about have an interesting way of penetrating our consciousness. And although I didn't realize it at the time, those conversations he was having with me played a role in shaping the kinds of things I would become interested in later on in life. And so fast forward, I get to college and I take my first psychology class at the University of Pennsylvania. And about halfway through the semester, we get to the topic of introspection, the science of turning your attention inward. And when we got to that topic, I thought, you know, finally, this is the stuff that I've spent so much time talking to my dad about. I've got this. But what I learned in that class was that a lot of people do exactly what my dad told me to do when they're struggling. They try to turn their attention inward to try to find a solution to their problems, but they often end up stumbling instead. They don't get better. In fact, these attempts to go inside make their problems worse. And so for me, this became a real puzzle. Why did my dad tell me that this was so helpful? I had my own positive experiences with introspection, as many others have as well. So why did it work for some people some of the time, but not for others at other moments in time? And that paradox, that puzzle really energized me and led me to go to graduate school to learn how to use the tools of science and neuroscience to try to answer it. And that's what I've been doing ever since.
Wow. A couple of things, right? One is the fact that your dad was having these conversations from the age of 3 or 5, you said. It's fascinating. It's never too early. I mean, my kids are 8 and 12, so it's a healthy reminder.
Get going. you might want to not do it when their friends come over wanting to play, you know.
Got it. It's true. Discretion advised. The other thing is, the last podcast conversation I had was with a gentleman who studied the Mahabharata, of which Bhagavad Gita is sort of is subset. So we spoke at length about, you know, sort of the right versus right kind of dilemmas that the Bhagavad Gita often touches on. Let's dive into the book, Ethan. You say that chatter consists of cyclical negative thoughts and emotions that turn our singular capacity for introspection into a curse rather than a blessing. Can you sort of expand on that for us and define what you mean by chatter?
Sure. So we have this remarkable tool. We can use language to work through our problems, and we can do it silently. We call that capacity our inner voice. So you turn your attention, we try to verbally work through a problem. You may think about what, you know, rehearsing a speech or what you might say to someone else, trying to motivate yourself, trying to create a story to explain your circumstances. This all involves turning your attention inward and using language to work through a problem. It's an incredible tool, a very valuable asset. Yet sometimes we try to activate this tool when we're struggling, we have big, big problems, and it doesn't work well for us. Instead, it in a certain sense jams up. So we've got a problem. Let's say we were just rejected or insulted by someone. Why did this happen? We try to think through that problem, often because we want to learn from our experiences and move on. But instead of coming up with that solution, we start stumbling. We just keep on rehearsing what happened to us and why we felt in ways that keep our negative emotions alive. And so that cycling over what happened to me, why did I feel this way, and that inability to work through and resolve the experience, that's what I call chatter. And I think it's one of the big problems that we face as a species.
Now, one of the people I spoke to on this podcast was a lady called Tasha Urich, who's done some work on self-awareness. And she uses a phrase, a rabbit hole of rumination. And she says sometimes introspection, if we don't do it well, we can end up going that rabbit hole and it can be counterproductive.
Right. So chatter, you know, chatter is a term that encompasses rumination. So in case you haven't figured this out yet, I'm sure you have, and many of your listeners have as well, scientists are really good at creating distinctions between slightly different things and coming up with different phrases to describe them. So rumination, perseveration, worry, and there's a whole host of additional terms that are often used to refer to this process of getting stuck in a negative thought. And so I use the term chatter to capture the breadth of those different experiences, all of which the common feature is looping over the negative thoughts, going down the rabbit hole, sucked into that vortex of negativity that won't let you free.
And you say that while the inner voice functions well most of the time, it often leads to chatter precisely when we need it the most, when our stress levels are high, when the stakes are high, and when we encounter difficult emotions that call for the utmost poise. So can you talk a little bit about that paradox in terms of when we need it most and when it lets us down the most?
Yeah, so we often need the tool the most when we're struggling with big emotions that command our attention and don't let us focus on anything else until those emotions are essentially resolved and subside. The problem is that experiencing stress often engages many of the brain networks that we use to manage the stress. So if you think of the frontal cortex, which plays a key role in helping us downregulate negative emotions, it also plays a role in keeping those negative emotions active. So it's as though the very resource that we possess that is useful for helping us manage the mind is depleted when we most need it. And that's where I think it's so valuable to understand what tools exist for helping people navigate this impasse so that they can, in fact, regain control of their mind, so to speak, when they find themselves slipping down this rabbit hole.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman. Here's the clip from my conversation with Tasha Urick, where she speaks about the rabbit hole of rumination. She talks about the language we use for introspection and suggests that we use the what question rather than the why question. She refers to some of the practices of people that she calls self-awareness unicorns, individuals who've really applied deliberate practice to enhancing the self-awareness.
Who would want to promote me? And you can kind of get stuck in, I call it the rabbit hole of rumination. And so what we wanted to do in our study was understand, okay, if why is the wrong question, what is the right question? You know, what are these unicorns doing differently than the rest of us? And it took us a little while to find this pattern, but we discovered that when unicorns introspected, they almost never asked why questions. They asked what questions. And at first I thought like, oh, that's just a weird sort of fluke or a weird nuance. But as we started to look into it, it started to make a huge amount of sense. So one example would be, you know, going back to the question, why didn't I get that promotion? Mm-hmm. Unicorns, if they were in that situation, wouldn't ask themselves that question. Here's some questions they might have asked instead. What did I learn that can help me be better positioned in the future? Or what can I do to close the gap between, you know, where I thought I was and where I need to be? Or what support can I enlist from the people around me to help me, you know, achieve this goal the next time I set it? Or, you know, going back to why am I so upset about that conversation with my coworker? They might instead ask, well, what part of that situation did I own? Or what can I do differently in the future to avoid that kind of conversation with that person? And so what we found was asking what instead of why really helps us avoid so many of the pitfalls of introspection, where we, you know, we're excavating for the truth that we're never going to find, and we're focusing on our problems and feeling victimized and disempowered.
As Ethan says, the challenge is that the same leg that's supposed to press down the brakes in the car is busy pushing down on the accelerator. Let's now get back to the conversation with Ethan to understand some of the tools and methods that we could use to apply the brakes on the chatter. Let's talk about some of the tools, Ethan. I did have a few things I wanted to dive deep in, but maybe just to present an overview to the listeners, what kinds of tools do we have access to when we encounter chatter in our lives?
Well, we have access to an enormous set of tools. And when I say tools, everything I'm talking about is science-based. I think that's an important feature to distinguish because, this is obviously a topic that has captured many people's attention. And sometimes the advice given is great and grounded in science, but sometimes it's not. And in fact, I review a few instances in my book of cases in which advice that is often given can be somewhat harmful, and we'll probably get to that at some point. Hmm. But one thing to know about the tools before I start going into individual ones is that there's no single magic pill. I think this is a really important point for people to be aware of. What we have learned is that we have evolved to possess many different tools for managing our mind. And the flexible use of different tools is something that many scientists believe is really useful. So people often ask me, hey, what is the one thing that I should do to manage my chatter? I can't answer that question based on science, because what we know is different tools work for different people in different situations. So I guess the way I would answer what's the best thing I can do to manage my chatter would be educate yourself about the range of tools that are out there, and you can find the ones that work best for you. Okay, so that's my disclaimer. Let's dive into tools. I like to organize this space into three categories. There are tools you can use on your own, tools that involve other people and our relationships, and then tools that are relevant to the world, tools that you could find in your physical environment. So ways of interacting with your physical spaces that impact the way we talk to ourselves and can help alleviate rumination. So do you want to get started with one category?
Sure. Sure. The first one was sort of intuitive. The second and third, if you want to sort of give a couple of examples for us to get a sense of what kinds of tools do you have in mind when you say physical space and when you say relationships?
Yeah. So let's start with physical space. I find this quite magical in many ways, that there are tools that are just waiting for you to find and use out there. They're freely available. And if you know where to find them in the world around you, they can benefit you. So let me give a couple of examples. So here's a little personal reveal. When I'm not dealing with chatter, which fortunately is most of the time, my office is usually pretty messy. And there's usually a trail of clothing in the bedroom to my wife's dismay, right? Like a towel on the floor and my underwear and then the sock. Come on, pick up your, a little tiff is about cleaning up. When I have chatter, though, I've always done something very out of character for myself, which is I put everything away. I make sure everything is nice and neat. When I finish cleaning up for myself and organizing my own space, I'll go and organize the kitchen. When I'm done with that, I will engage in the masochistic feat of cleaning up my children's room. Now, there's science that explains what I'm doing. And it actually has a role to play in reducing chatter. And it's something that many people do. Many people clean and organize when they're experiencing chatter. One of the things we know about human beings is that human beings crave order and control. We like to know that the world is a predictable, orderly place. We like to know that because it's much easier for us to navigate contexts that are orderly, that we know what's going to happen. When you are experiencing chatter, you feel like you don't have order and control because your mind's taking over. It's taking you to places where you don't necessarily want to be and you don't know where you're going to go next. So you don't have control of what's happening in your mind. That's the feeling. What we've learned is that people can compensate for feeling out of control of their mind by exerting control on their surroundings. So when I create order around me, when I organize my space, that gives me a sense of control, which helps me feel better about my circumstances more generally. We call this process compensatory control. It's also one of the reasons why people often engage in rituals. Many athletes, for example, when they're in situations where they can't predict what's going to happen, they're competing, they will often spontaneously engage in rituals. for a very similar reason. They provide them with a sense of control. I can, you know, twirl my hair three times and bounce the ball four times. That's something under my control. Can't determine whether my serve is going to be in check or how my opponent's going to return it, but I can control this. So that's one example of an environmental tool.
And you talk about Rafael Nadal in the book. I guess he fits that example of sort of really organizing your right from the water bottles when you're sort of taking a break between games, right?
That's exactly right. Nadal is, Nadal's a really interesting example. He's one of the greatest tennis players of all time, if not the greatest. I guess it depends where your allegiances lie. But
I'm still in the Federer camp, but yeah, I would have to grudgingly admit. Yeah.
Within a couple more years. And during an interview several years ago, a journalist, I believe it was a journalist, asked him what was the hardest thing he struggled with on the tennis court. And his answer surprised a lot of people because he didn't say the hardest thing he struggled with was maintaining his endurance or returning his opponent's backhand. It was managing the voice inside his head, right? It was the game that was the most difficult component for him. And if you've ever watched him play, you actually know what he does to manage that chatter. Nadal is famous for engaging in elaborate rituals. So from the time walks onto the court, how he carries his bag and walks to his bench, to the way he positions his water bottles, to the routines he engages in before every single serve. He's highly ritualistic. And when asked why he does that, he has said, and something to the effect of, I order my surroundings to match the order I seek in my head. So he's using this tool. I should add that this is an ancient tool. I mean ancient in the sense that cultures have relied on rituals to help deal with chatter-provoking experiences for quite a long time, like mourning the loss of a loved one. How do you deal with that uncertainty and distress? Well, cultures don't wait for you to figure out the answer to that question. They give it right to you. I know exactly what ritual I should engage in when someone close to me passes away. And so this is a way that society has evolved to help us manage chatter. It's one way that it's helped us evolve. So I think rituals are fascinating. There is a caveat. People often ask, hey, wait a second, what about things like obsessive compulsive disorder and certain kinds of anxiety disorders that are characterized by rituals? And my response to that is there are certainly cases in which rituals can be over-relied on and overused to the point that they become harmful. If you feel that you have to perform a ritual, and if you don't perform it, something bad is going to happen and that becomes disruptive to your life, that's not good. But in that sense, a ritual is really no different from many other tools, which if taken to an extreme can be harmful. If you think about the kinds of tools we're talking about as akin to a physical tool, I think this all comes full picture. So if you think about a hammer as an example, hammer can be the source of enormous innovation and creativity. Like I'm sitting in a home right now that was built largely by hammer. Right? Hammer being used to erect the home I live in. But a hammer can also be the source of destruction if it's used in the wrong context or the wrong degree. So what we want to figure out is how to use these tools appropriately in the right proportions. And that's something I think the science can help us figure out.
Got it. Now, one of the things you said triggered something. You spoke about rituals to manage chatter. I think the other thing I've noticed is around key phases of transition, you know, whether it's, you know, in the transition in the context of losing someone or even in our phases of life, when you move from being a bachelor to getting married or different transitions, I find that they are often marked with rituals. It's interesting that you frame it as an opportunity to manage chatter. I hadn't quite framed it that way.
It's positioned as
a celebratory, in some cases celebratory, in some cases grieving, but chatter is an interesting frame to see the need or the use case for some of these rituals.
Yeah, well, I think that's the activator of many of these tools. Transition periods are we know that these are among the most stressful times of life that human beings experience. And many of us seem to reflexively engage in tools to help us deal with those that kind of uncertainty that surrounds those transitions. I find it fascinating that many of us intuit what to do without really knowing why or how. And so in my book, I talk about close to 30 different tools. I think some people may have spontaneously stumbled on some of those tools in their lives without knowing why, but they've used some of them. And my hope is that educating people about the science surrounding those tools, what it gives people the prospect of doing is being more deliberate so that you don't have to wait to stumble on a tool, but you can rather be more proactive in how you utilize it. So to make that concrete, whereas before I knew about all the science, I might, you know, find myself organizing when I'm really overcome with chatter, not knowing why, just kind of reflexively do it. Now, I know immediately, as soon as I see the chatter begin to brew, I've got a plan. I start cleaning up a little bit. I do some other things. And what that has done for me is it shortens the amount of time that I spend in chatter. I'm able to bypass it before it elevates. And that's a great service that knowing about the science provides.
And from a self-awareness perspective, Ethan, just for me to understand, where is the line between, let's say, the inner voice and inner chatter? When does it tip over to becoming unhealthy? Do you have sort of a rule of thumb for it?
Yeah, it's a great question. I wish I could, you know, it would be a dream if I could do a blood test to figure that out, or have a little chatter thermometer that physiologically indicated that, oh, you're in the harmful zone right now. The best we can do at the moment is a more subjective appraisal of where you stand. And the indicator for me is it's not about whether you're engaging in negative self-talk. Many people think, I want to rid my life of all negative self-talk. That's not actually a goal that I would argue is a healthy goal or an attainable one. What I mean by that is this. Negative emotions are functional when they're experienced in the right proportions. It is healthy and adaptive to become angry for a short period of time when insulted. The experience of envy when you come across some colleague or friend who's achieved in a way that you haven't, that can be very motivating and has been shown to be such. The anxiety that I experience when I think about all of the things I have to do next week, that's useful because what it allows me to do is not just watch TV and read for fun, but actually do the work that I need to do to prepare. So negative emotions in small doses are great. And with those negative emotions comes that negative self-talk. What makes those emotions harmful is when they're prolonged. So if you find yourself turning over the same negative experience in your mind in a way that's not, you know, progress forward and take constructive action, that's an indication that chatter is taking hold. If you find yourself sitting at the dinner table with your family, asking your family questions that they answer and respond to, but which you don't hear. You hear physically, of course, what they're saying, but you don't attend to it. So you ask them to repeat themselves, whereupon they say, I just told you that. That's an indication that the chatter is becoming harmful. If you find yourself unable to sleep at night because your mind is racing over the negativity, not allowing you to turn off your brain for the 8 hours that you need to get the slumber, that's a sign that the chatter is taking over.
Got it. Just moving to some of the tools that you talk about in the book, Ethan, the one that caught my attention was time travel. You talk about mental time travel. I was also trying to reconcile that with this notion of being present and this whole discourse around mindfulness. So can you talk a little bit about the effectiveness of time travel and dealing with chatter, but also how you think about that in the context of this discussion that's happening around mindfulness today?
Yeah, happy to. So we hear a lot that you want to be in the present, focus on the present, and that message is often delivered. It's wrapped around the kind of mindfulness industry, and so my feelings on that are this: I think mindfulness is wonderful as a practice, And I think there are many moments in life where being focused on the present, being able to refocus our attention on the present, can serve a boon to our well-being. I should disclose, by the way, that I've been meditating on and off since the time I was 5 years old. Wow. I think I mentioned this in the book, but my dad, on my fifth birthday, I desperately wanted, like, you know, a bicycle. And instead he picked me up from school and said, "I got a great surprise for you." And he took me to the Transcendental Meditation Center in Manhattan. And I got a mantra. I learned how to meditate. So,
evolved parenting for that time, I must say.
Yeah. He was an interesting guy. So I say this to genuinely communicate that I am pro mindfulness, pro meditation. I've researched it myself, shown some benefit, and I've done it myself. I say that because now I'm going to give not a critique, but I want to make the situation a little bit more nuanced. Mm-hmm. I think mindfulness is an example of one tool amidst many that people can use to manage chatter. Likewise, I think focusing on the present can be useful in certain contexts. But I think it is incredibly important for people to know that the human mind did not evolve to be fixated on the present. In fact, we evolved to be able to travel in time in our mind. And this capacity, I would argue, is an essential feature of a human mind that lets us do remarkable things. My ability to travel in time in the mind lets me do things like learn from my past experiences so I don't repeat mistakes. My ability to travel in time in the mind lets me prepare for future engagements so I perform well. It lets me fantasize about things that might happen in ways that enrich my well-being. Now, there's nothing wrong with mental time travel on its own. The problem is that we often get in our mental time travel machines. We go back in time to figure out something, to try to learn from a past mistake, and our time travel machines break down, right? Mm. That's when we get stuck ruminating. Or we go into the future to try to prepare for something maybe negative, but we get stuck there too. Just what if this happens? What if that happens? And when that happens, we've got a couple of options. One option is, all right, well, let's just bring the time machine back to the present. And that can certainly be useful for helping us. And I think that's what certain pieces of mindfulness help teach us how to do. But there's also another option, which is not to come back to the present, but to figure out how can you travel in time more effectively without your time travel machine getting stuck. And many of the tools I talk about in the book are designed to help us do that. They are designed to help us figure out, for example, how do you go back and think about a really painful event so that you can learn from it, but without getting stuck in that moment in ways that are harmful. So that's my feeling about mental time travel, being in the present. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I do think, however, that an exclusive focus on living in the present is an unattainable goal that probably wouldn't be healthy, actually.
Hmm. And picking up on the point about not getting stuck, Ethan, are there easy wins? Are there one or two thoughts around bringing it back that's helpful for the listeners, either from the past to the present or the future to the present?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are, you know, probably 28 more or so. I'll spare you and listeners from laundry listing them all.
But the ones that work for you, maybe, if I make it personal.
Let me give you a couple of highlights. You know, another physical environment tool, involves enhancing your exposure to green spaces in nature. And that can help us in a few different ways. On the one hand, there's been a lot of research which shows that going for a walk in a serene, safe setting can help restore our attention. Right? Our attention is often depleted when we're experiencing chatter because we're focusing so intently and trying to work the problem through, but we're not making any progress. And so we end up burning through our attentional reserves. And what happens when you go for a walk in a green setting is your attention drifts away gently from the problems you're struggling with to the beauty that surrounds you. And, you know, we start focusing on the surroundings, the green spaces, but we're not doing so in a very deliberate way. It's not like when I go for a walk in the park, I'm carefully studying the geometrical shape of the tree leaves and looking at their symmetrical patterns. I'm just kind of taking it in. That gives rise to this, what we call a restoration effect. So you leave the walk and you feel like you have more resources to manage the adversity that you're dealing with. That's one way that nature can help. Another thing that it can do is it can put us in a position to experience the emotion of awe, which is an emotion we experience when we're in the presence of something vast and indescribable, a tree that's been here for hundreds of years, or an amazing view. What happens when we experience awe is we go through something that scientists call a shrinking of the self. So you feel smaller when you're contemplating something vast and indescribable. And when you feel smaller, so does your chatter. So I'll give you a real world example here. I'm worried about something at work. I go to the local park a few blocks from my house. I go for a walk and I look out and I'm looking at this river that has been here for how many thousands of years. I'm looking at these trees actually in the arboretum by my house. Some of the trees have like a little plaque that says how long they've been here. And I'm thinking to myself, these trees are decades older than me. They've weathered so much adversity, right? And then I think about the little problem I'm dealing with. Experiencing that emotion of awe has the ability to broaden our perspective in ways that can be really helpful for keeping our chatter at bay. So those are a couple of physical things. You asked me about some of my other go-to strategies when I'm experiencing chatter. Mental time travel is definitely one. So that's what I do if I wake up at 2 a.m. with some chatter. It happens every 4 to 5 weeks. I don't know why, but I'll randomly wake up in the middle of the night, wide-eyed and worried. And when that happens, I will engage in a specific mental time travel strategy that we call temporal distancing. I'll think about, how am I going to feel about this thing that's bothering me tomorrow morning or next week? And what that does for me is it makes me realize that whatever I'm going through right now, as awful as it feels, it reminds me that it's temporary and it will eventually pass, which gives me hope that I'll feel better, which makes the chatter better. Because what I've learned in my life, as I think most listeners have, is that we all experience adversity at times. We all experience the big emotions and deep chatter, but eventually we come out of that. We move on to something else, sometimes another bout of chatter, but we do eventually come out of it. We lose sight of that fact when we're in the midst of chatter, and that can be really upsetting. So I'll do temporal distancing in that way. I'll also do something that we call distant self-talk, which is I'll try to give myself advice like I would give advice to a close friend, and I'll use language to help me do that. So I'll actually use my name to coach myself through a problem. I won't do this in front of others out loud, of course. That would be very strange. But in my mind, I'll say, Ethan, here's how you're going to manage this situation. One of the things we know about people is we are much better at giving advice to other people than we are giving advice to ourselves. And this tool, this distant self-talk, it really capitalizes on that mechanism. Because if you think about it, when do we use names and words like you? We use those parts of speech when we think about and refer to other people. So when you use your own name to refer to yourself, that in a certain sense turns on the mind machinery for thinking about others. It makes you, puts you in this more objective standpoint, which makes it much easier for you to coach yourself through your problem. So those are some of my go-tos.
Well, lovely. On the last point, Ethan, when I was at McKinsey, we would often say, you know, Marvin Bower was one of the early partners who played a big role in shaping the values and the culture of the firm. So a tool or a ritual that the partners would urge the youngsters to engage in is, what would Marvin do? You know, in this situation, ask yourself the question. I don't think it's quite what you just described, but I guess at some level, it's a distancing thing.
It's a distancing mechanism for sure, because you are broadening the perspective and looking at it from a different angle. The difference between the tool that I described and the Marvin Bower tool is that when I'm using my name, I'm still thinking about the circumstances from my own perspective. So it's pretty. Yeah, to weigh in on the situation from my own unique vantage point, which would be different than had I said, what would Marvin do? What would my dad do here? That could be, that could also be quite useful, but then you're adopting the lens of that other individual. Now, I assure you, if I pick the wrong person to ask to engage in that perspective taking exercise, I might not come up with the best solution.
Great point.
But it certainly falls under this category of distancing tools.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. I must say that of the various things Ethan says, nature is often a challenge when it comes to cities like Mumbai. I also find that some phrases that we use casually have a deeper meaning. For instance, the phrase, go take a walk, has an interesting history to it. One of our earlier guests, Jennifer Goldman-Wetzler, speaks about it here.
Take a walk. Ask someone to go take a walk rather than sitting and talking to each other. The movement, there's something about movement, especially if you're someone who you know about yourself that you are a kinesthetic person. And also you can ask yourself, who are the other people involved here and who will I be talking to? And are they someone who might appreciate nature or the outdoors or getting a breath of fresh air or the movement as well? And that's a great question to ask.
Like Ethan says, taking a walk, being exposed to nature and some sort of movement can help break the chatter, I guess. If you're finding the podcast of value, do take a moment to rate and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you consume the content. It will make a big difference in terms of helping people discover this podcast from the thousands of others out there. It'll also help future guests build confidence in the work we do as they evaluate whether this podcast is a good ROI on their time. Let's now get back to Ethan Cross. And in the book, you use a phrase which stayed with me. You say that we can think of the mind as a lens and our inner voice as a button that zooms it either in or out. I just thought, that notion of the voice is the one that sort of controls how close or how remote we are to a situation. I thought, when I read it, it felt agentic, the fact that we have control over, do we want to be zoomed in or zoomed out?
Well, I think this issue of control is a really interesting one. And individual differences abound on people's assessments of the extent to which they have such control. There's actually research which has looked at, is there variability in how much people think they can control their emotions? The answer to that is yes, there's tremendous variability. But then the work shows, does it matter if you simply think you can control your emotions for bringing about positive outcomes? And compellingly, the answer is yes, which makes a lot of sense to me. One of the first things I learned in graduate school is the ability to manage our emotional lives has two pieces or two core components. There's motivation and there's ability. And you need both of those pieces to be successful. You can know about every single tool that's out there, but if you're not motivated to use those tools, nothing is going to happen. On the flip side, you can be super motivated to manage your emotional life and believe it's possible, but if you don't know what the tools are, you're not going to be successful. So you really need both of those pieces. And, I think they're easily attainable.
One of the earlier guests in the podcast was a gentleman called BJ Fogg of Stanford, who actually talks about this almost like an indifference curve, where you've got motivation and ability and how you sort of, in the realm of habit forming, you need to ensure that you're sort of operating on the right side of the curve. Got it.
Yeah, BJ, I'm familiar with BJ's work and I'm a great admirer of it. And I believe this motivation ability distinction factors heavily into his model of habit formation. He has an additional element to it,
trigger
situations and triggers. But but I think at its core, it taps into something very fundamental and also easy for people to remember. And I think that's also, one of the things it's important. Let me close a thought. A lot of the science that we're talking about today, and that I talk about in my book, is science that has been built on the shoulders of decades of very complicated, deep, nuanced research. Often the take-homes from that work are really, really simple. And I think that is in many ways great, because I think for communicating this work for folks, like there are some simple nuggets, to use your phrase, that we can remind ourselves of when we're experiencing adversity. And that's not always the case in science, right? Sometimes you have very complicated research that is also really complicated to describe. And I don't think that's necessarily the case in this domain.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. Building on what Ethan says, one of my earlier guests, BJ Fogg of Stanford University, who's authored the book Tiny Habits, speaks about the role of prompts in addition to motivation and ability.
So I knew motivation, ability, how they work together. And I knew that making something super simple would let you be consistent in creating a habit. But then it's like, how do you prompt it? How do you prompt it? And then that just happened, like a lot of breakthroughs. You know, there's literally was getting out of the shower and it's like, oh my gosh, it's after. You figure out what this comes after and you use the preceding behavior to remind you of the next thing, this new habit that you want. And so then it all clicked, and then I knew I had all the pieces in place, because it always comes back to just motivation, ability, prompt. And then I knew I had, here's this breakthrough way of habits where you're hacking three things. One, you're making the behavior super tiny, so you don't need much motivation. Two, you are prompting it through something you already do, an existing routine that we call an anchor in Tiny Habits. And then three, you manipulate your emotion so your brain takes notice and goes, whoa, that feels good. I want to do that again in the future. And so you don't leave that to chance. You deliberately celebrate and cause that emotion to fire off, which then changes the regulation of dopamine in the brain.
He goes on to speak about different kinds of prompts, whether internal or external, that could help us get things done. To know more about this, you can just go to playtopotential.com and visit the guest section and look up the conversation with BJ Fogg. Let's now get back to the conversation with Ethan Cross. Another phrase you use in the book, Ethan, is a phonological loop. And you make a distinction between the inner voice and an inner ear. Can you sort of talk about the distinction for us here?
Yeah, well, let me give you the frame on this distinction. So every few months or more, there's always a debate on the internet about whether some people have an inner voice or don't have it at all. And I think that debate emerges in part from defining the inner voice differently. People define it in different ways. I think any well-functioning mind has an inner voice in the following sense. A fundamental feature of the human mind is that we have a working memory system, basic system of the human mind that lets us keep information active in our heads for short periods of time. We often think about memory as the province of things that happened long ago, but actually things that happened just seconds ago also fall onto this terrain of memory. And so working memory is that capacity to keep nuggets of information active. So like memorizing a phone number or repeating a grocery list in your head. And one facet of working memory is what we call verbal working memory, which is essentially the province of the inner voice. And scientists have discovered what they call this phonological loop, which is this capacity to keep verbal information active and reverberating in your head for short periods of time, so that when you go to the grocery store and you initially forget what you were supposed to buy and you walk down the aisle and then you remind yourself, you go down the list, eggs, cheese, apples. Now, don't forget, eggs, cheese, apples, you're rehearsing that. That's you activating that phonological loop. And there are two components. There's this, inner voice component, which involves articulating the word, but there's also this inner ear. So we can actually hear the information we are uttering in our minds. And if you look in the brain, there are somewhat dissociable neural networks that characterize some of these processes.
Mm-hmm. What's the link with chatter here, Ethan? How do these help manage chatter?
Well, there's nothing about the phonological loop per se that helps us manage chatter. What the phonological loop does is it makes it clear that the inner voice and your ability to use language silently to reflect on your lives is a very, very basic and fundamental feature of the human mind. And so the phonological loop is a kind of substrate that explains how this inner voice operates.
Got it.
You could argue that when people are experiencing chatter, that loop is just filled with really harmful information.
The other piece that got my attention, Ethan, was you talk about journaling. You say that even simply asking people to write about their most negative experiences for 15, 20 minutes leads them to feel better, visit the doctor less, and have a healthier immune function. Can you talk about the link between journaling, psychological distance, and well-being?
Yeah. So when we're talking about journaling in technical terms, we're talking about expressive writing, which involves describing in writing your deepest thoughts and feelings surrounding a negative experience. And what we've learned over time is that creating a narrative around one's experience can often be really useful, because what it does is it helps people put a structure on their experiences. They're telling a story, and stories usually have beginnings, middles, and importantly, ends. And so telling those stories can provide us with a sense of closure and meaning that ultimately allow us to move on with our lives. There is some research, this is some work that we've done in our lab, that has looked at links between journaling and distancing. One of the interesting things about writing about your own life is that you become the character in a story. So an author is actually writing about a character, but the character is you. So there does seem to be a distancing function that expressive writing has. You know, you're almost stepping back and writing about your own life, and there is a distancing feature associated with that. But there's lots of research which shows that expressive writing can be very helpful. It's another tool in the chatter toolbox.
And when you say expressive writing, just for me to understand the nuance here, it's about expressing emotions around events and situations.
It's about writing about your deepest thoughts and feelings about an experience. So that's the instruction that is given to participants in many expressive writing studies. And what eventually happens when you do that for 15 to 20 minutes for anywhere from 1 to 3 consecutive days is that people start to tell stories about the event. Right. So they're going deep, they're going into it, and they're creating these narratives, which have increasingly some sense of coherence, meaning, and structure. And those narratives can be helpful.
Got it. The other theme that was interesting, Ethan, was you talk about how we provide support effectively when somebody is going through a rough patch. And you say that we need to offer the right balance of listening and empathy and problem solving. Once again, to understand how we walk that tightrope, I was curious about, you know, how you think about offering support if you're on the receiving end of chatter. What's your experience on that front?
Well, I think this is a really important issue because in popular culture, we're often told that what you want to do when you're experiencing chatter is just find someone to vent your emotions, to just get it out. There's been a lot of research on this process. And what we've learned is that venting can be really helpful for strengthening the friendship and relational bonds between two people. It feels good to know there are other people there who are willing to take time to listen and connect with us. The problem with venting is if all you do in a conversation is vent about your problems, you often leave that conversation just as upset, if not more upset, as when you started. Because all you've done is kept the negative stuff active in your minds. The best conversations when it comes to chatter allow us to do two things. First, it is important to find someone who allows us to express our feelings to a certain degree. Establishing those relational empathy connections is really useful. But at a certain point in the conversation, the person you're speaking with ideally helps broaden your perspective. They help you look at that bigger picture in ways that ultimately allow you to find meaning and reach a sense of closure that allows you to move on. So there's this balance between wanting to talk to people who can both empathize and connect, but also help coach you through the problem. And I call those people in my life my chatter advisors. And I don't have many, but I have enough. And I think the take home here for listeners is twofold. It's number one, if you're experiencing chatter, be really thoughtful about who you speak to about it, because speaking to anyone isn't necessarily going to be helpful. There are some people in my life who I'm extremely close with. I love them. I respect them. I never talk to them about my chatter because I know that the way that they're going to try to help me is by just allowing me to vent, which isn't going to serve me in the long run. So the people I talk to instead are the 3 to 5 people who I know are adept at not just listening and getting me to vent, also helping broaden my perspective. And so I've got those people on my speed dial list, and it's a resource that I avail myself of when I'm struggling. So that's one take home. The second take home is if you are on the other side of the equation and someone is coming to you, a colleague, a loved one for chatter support, be mindful of these two principles. Take the time to listen and connect. But at a certain point in the conversation, when you see your opening, try to help them work through that experience. Now, there is an art to doing this well. I wish I could tell listeners, okay, the thing you want to do is listen and let them vent for 96 seconds, and then shift into problem solving. It doesn't work this way. We are way too complicated. To expect it to be that simple, I think, does disjustice to the beauty of the human condition. So the art to doing this well involves taking the time to listen and connect. And then sometimes it can be apparent when you should start shifting into that coaching mode. But if it's not, my suggestion is to ask the person you're talking to, hey, I totally get it, but I have an idea. Can I ask you a question? Sometimes I'll pose that question to someone I'm talking with and they'll say, please, yes, tell me, what do you think? Or what should I do about this? That's why I'm talking to you. Sometimes I'll be ready for feedback. Other conversations, the person I'm talking to will say, no, just keep moving. I'm not ready yet. And that's fine, because depending on the person and the circumstance they're dealing with, some people may need to spend more time in that empathy zone before they're ready to shift into the cognitive zone. But those are the principles of providing and receiving good chatter support.
And back to your point about having, let's say, 4 to 5 chatter advisors on your speed dial, is there, if you had to sort of think about what are the 3-4 characteristics, unifying characteristics that they possess, are there things that stand out?
There's either an implicit or explicit awareness of how these principles operate. And what I mean by that is there's some people on this list who have what you might describe as a high socio-emotional intelligence factor. They are in tune to the fact that the emotional connection is really important, but that you also need to help people actually concretely deal with problems and find solutions. Some people, for reasons we don't know, maybe some of it inbuilt or absorbed from their early childhood experiences, just have that intuition. And there are a couple of people on the list like that. But then there are other folks on the list who actually are aware of this sign. These are colleagues, friends who are psychologically oriented and know how this stuff works. And for that reason, are quite deliberate in how they talk to you about these things. Now, I should add, the people on this list, they're not doing therapy. There may be a therapist on it, but just as a matter of coincidence, I'm friends with one. It's not a formal therapeutic exchange. What we're talking about in many ways is having really powerful relationships that you can rely on to help you work through chatter-provoking circumstances. Other people are in an ideal position to help us because they have distance from the problem. They can be that objective guidepost that we can lean on. And so it's just a matter of finding the right individuals who are capable of actualizing the potential they have.
Got it. Just the last couple of questions on this podcast, Ethan. You talk about the COVID pandemic being arguably the most chatter-provoking event of the century. What's been your observation about how it's played out in different lives and, you know, if in terms of application of your research in the context of COVID, what would you like to tell the listeners to sort of move forward into the new normal?
Well, I think, it's an interesting time to publish a book right on this topic, right when COVID started, because we know that some of the fuel that drives chatter are uncertainty and a lack of control, which I think have been the kind of guiding theme surrounding COVID, at least at the early stages, still to some extent now. And we've seen the effects of that in data. You know, last time I checked, there were 30+% increases in various forms of anxiety and stress, which we know chatter plays a key role in governing. So we've certainly seen a huge rise. There's also data showing that a lot of the different tools I talk about and others can be quite useful for helping people manage this COVID stress. And so, there are solutions. There are many good reasons to have hope. What I like to remind people is that although rates of chatter may be up 30%, the overwhelming majority of people are still faring quite well. And so there's a lot of room to manage ourselves more effectively. And I think that's a remarkable thing.
Lovely. As we wrap up, Ethan, this podcast is titled Play to Potential. When you hear that phrase, what does that mean to you? How do you think about play to potential?
I think playing to potential means is a fantastic aspirational goal. And I think a key piece of that involves removing the obstacles that we sometimes put in our own way. Sometimes life throws obstacles in our way, but I would argue we often create obstacles to living up to our potential. I think chatter is a perfect example of that. And I think familiarizing yourself with the tools that are out there for managing it has the potential to help people live up to that ultimate potential.
Lovely. With that, Ethan, thank you so much for making the time.
Thanks for having me.
I hope you found the conversation purposeful. Do take a moment to rate and review the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever else you consume the content. It will really mean a lot for us to get this podcast to others and for listeners to discover us amidst thousands of other podcasts out there. To learn more about my work as an executive coach and a discreet sounding board with CEOs and entrepreneurs, you can go to playtopotential.com and see the About Deepak section. Thank you, and look forward to having you at a subsequent conversation at this podcast. Bye now.